This is Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel.
Welcome back to Inside the Wolf's Den with your hosts, Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel. Today we have a guest for you, Mark Owens. How are you doing, Mark?
Very good, thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us today. Just a quick bio on Mark. So Mark Owens was in the IT business when in 2002 he bought his first rental. A few years later, he began to flip houses and wholesale. By 2021, Mark had wholesaled over 200 properties and owned a little over 100 rental properties. His main market is in Baltimore, Maryland. And in the spring of 2021, he decided to sell a good portion of his rental portfolio and spend more time chasing his hobbies and traveling. Mark has been married to Lisa since 1996 and has an amazing son, James. He is also a private pilot, scuba diver, and creative problem-solving junkie. So it's awesome to see that you've had so much success, Mark. And I know that every successful person has a story, and there is a story behind you. I've heard a little bit about it. So I would love for you to kind of tell us a little about yourself, give some background, and how you got here.
Wow, that's
a long story.
It's a long story. Okay, we got time. Remember you said that.
It's a little different. Yeah, we all have a different story. Mm-hmm. And we've all faced our own struggles and challenges and family drama and all that stuff. So I'll preface it with that. I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning, and I'm just going to kind of fast forward through, and then you can, you know, pick and choose anywhere that you'd like to go deeper.
Sure.
I was born in 1965 in Baltimore City. My mother was 17 years old at the time. She was married. They got divorced shortly after I was born. She got married again when I was 2, divorced when I was 6, met another guy when I was like 8. I think she married him when I was around 10. Around the age of 12, I grew up in the city, like a blue collar, working man's neighborhood, childhood dream, drive a forklift at a factory. That was, you know, pretty much the way that my peers like looked at the world. And around the age of 12, I started smoking pot, which a lot of people are surprised by that, but in inner city, like, you know, neighborhoods, like that's not that uncommon. So around the age of 12, started smoking weed, cigarettes, 13, started drinking, you know, 14, whatever I could get my hands on, speed, other pills that people have never heard of now, like, you know, Valiums and Quaaludes and stuff like that. 14, 15, LSD, mushrooms. Mm. And then I get kicked out of high school in my senior year, November of my senior year. I was almost there, and got kicked out for chronic absenteeism because I'd rather go, you know, hang out in the woods with my friends than sit down and study proverbs and adjectives and adverbs and all that stuff. So moved back to my grandma's house, who still lived in the city in my neighborhood. And in February of 1983, when I was 17, I started shooting coke and heroin. Mm-hmm. And that brings about a whole new set of challenges. And, you know, so over the next, I guess, 8 years, up till around the age of 24 or so, I spent a lot of time in and out of rehabs, got locked up a whole bunch of times, was homeless for periods of time, not for long stretches, not for months, but sometimes for a few weeks here and there, in different states in Maryland, California, Florida, Pennsylvania. And got arrested in, let me see, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Florida during that period of time. And it all came to a head around August of 89, when I just felt like I had nowhere else to go. Like, I just thought, like, my life is over. I can't stop doing this. I've tried you know, rehabs. I've tried churches. I've tried different girlfriends. I moved to different states. And I just thought that I was one of those people that just was never gonna like do it. I was just like, this is who I am, and I'm gonna just get high till I die. And so I had robbed a store a few years earlier, and I'd robbed several drug dealers during that time, and it was just too easy. So I just thought, like, I can't, you know, like, this is just too damn simple. I can't do this. And then I ended up robbing a bank outside of Philly. I think it was like maybe the beginning of August of 89. And a few days later, I had a sheriff come to my apartment to revoked my bail. I was already out on bail for a strong arm robbery. And I escaped from him and the bounty hunter, stole a car, drove to Baltimore. I think it was like the very next day the feds raided my apartment. My girlfriend didn't even know I did any of this stuff. She just knew I paid the rent. She didn't know how. Wow. And then the feds raided our apartment. And I just thought, well, this is it. You know, it's like I'm either going to just do this until I get shot or OD or something. And I was robbing stores like, you know, every day, sometimes two or three stores. I think it was like a couple of dozen by the time I got locked up, and stole a bunch of cars. And it was kind of strange. I mean, you probably not going to remember this because you weren't old enough, I'm assuming. There was this Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And they were hiring anybody. I mean, anybody. You just show up, wipe some oil off ducks and rocks and stuff like that, and you got a job. So I was thinking, you know what, maybe I'm going to head out to Alaska. I'm just going to like steal cars and gas to get out there. And maybe I can get my act together, like, you know, on a glacier in Alaska somewhere. Sorry about that. And so what happened was the night before I was supposed to leave, a girlfriend and I went out, got a motel room, robbed the store, bought some drugs, went our way back to the motel. And I ran a red light in a stolen car. I mean, that's like, you can't get any dumber than that. And so I did that, we ended up getting boxed in at an intersection where we couldn't drive. There were cars in front of us. This is like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I just, you know, the cops are with their guns out and all this stuff and telling us to get out of the car. And I asked her for the drugs and she handed me the drugs. And I just thought, well, I'm going to get out and I'm going to do my thing, which is, you know, I'm not going to be compliant. I'm just going to start running. And that's what I did. I got out with my hands up. And then as they got closer, I took off running. I remember like gritting my teeth, just waiting to get, you know, shot and thinking just like, don't stop running. Like if you get shot, just keep running. And it didn't take long. 10 minutes. They found me in a warehouse, like where I kind of got jammed up with some fences with razor wire and stuff like that. So got caught, went to Baltimore County Detention Center. A month after that, I tried to escape out of the detention center. And because I wasn't done, you know, it's like jail, prison wasn't part of my plan. My plan was to, you know, get shot or overdose or make it to Alaska and wipe some oil off some ducks, whatever. Those were my plans. And got caught, thank God, with the attempted escape. I had a meeting with my attorney a couple of weeks later, and I'm going to have to bleep myself here. And he, you know, we're sitting in the room alone and he looks at me and he says, man, what the is wrong with you? You know, can't you even stay out of trouble in jail? You're already locked up. Don't you realize if you do what you're supposed to do, you can be home by the time you're 30 years old, you'll be young enough to start a whole new life. And of course, as he said that, I felt like really stupid. And you ended up, you know, went back to my cell a little while later. And over the next couple of days, I started to think about what he said. Like, I could be home by the time I'm 30 years old. I'll be young enough to start a whole new life. And I thought, you know what? I got to do the time. That doesn't mean I got to waste it. I'm going to do the best that I can while I'm in here, as long as it is. And God knows I deserve it. Like, I mean, I knew I deserved it. There was never, you know, any question. I wasn't one of these guys. Well, I didn't do it. Like, I did it. I actually confessed to everything when I got locked up, everything. And I even would have told him stuff I did when I was 12. They said, like, that's enough. Like, we, you know, you don't have to tell us anything else. And so I thought about what he said. And I, you know, I just thought to myself, I'm going to have to figure this out. I don't know what, but I know there's a way to do it. And right about this time, the girl that I was with, she didn't get in any trouble. I, you know, took the responsibility for everything. So she didn't get in any trouble at all. And, but she got clean. Like somehow she did it. She was actually hanging out with a guy that became her boyfriend, who was the first person I ever shot cocaine with. And, you know, he had gone to a rehab like a couple weeks before I got locked up, and he was still clean, and they did it. So that kind of inspired me. Like, you know, these are the first people that I've met that I knew personally that were in that life that are getting it together. And so that really gave me a lot of inspiration. And it's funny. It's just like this, I don't know, like law of attraction or synchronicity. I don't have any other way to explain it other than I get off a lockup and I got onto the regular general population pod, and there was a book laying on the table. And I mean, I'd read like every Stephen King book I could get my hands on, every Louis L'Amour Western, like all, you know, all the typical jailhouse books. And then there was this book laying there called You Can If You Think You Can. And I looked it up and I turned it over and I read the back and I thought, and it was about like, you can become whatever you want in life if you believe in yourself. And I had never seen any self-help books. I mean, this is 1989. Back then, you know, like, what's the guy's name? Tony Robbins. He probably still needed help back then. And I read the, you know, so I thought, well, I'm going to, you know, I got plenty of time to read this book. And it was written the author was Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote, as I later found out, a more famous book called The Power of Positive Thinking. Mm-hmm. And this book, it was just something went off halfway through it. He convinced me that I could take control of myself in my life is if I believe in myself. And that's the complete opposite of AA and NA, where they say, oh, it's the higher power that gets all the credit, but if you mess up, it's your fault. And I thought, no, this is 100% me. If I screw up, that's my fault. If I do good, I'm taking credit for it. Mm-hmm. And so once this author convinced me that, back then you could smoke cigarettes in jail, and it was in the middle of the afternoon. I still remember it like it was yesterday. One of the cell guys, you know, one of the other guys that was locked up, I looked at him in the middle of the day and I said, Frank, here, man, take my cigarettes, quit. And that was it. And I quit smoking cigarettes. And it was the reasons why for me it was so important was because I wanted to show myself that I could take control of myself. I could take control of my life. I'm the master of the ship. Mm-hmm. And that was one way to show myself that I was serious, and also my family, to show them, like, you know, that I'm like, I mean business. And that was it. And I spent the next 4+ years. I was locked up about 4 years and 9 months on that one. And I just, you know, I mean, I went to, you know, I got an associate's degree. They actually have like colleges in some prisons. It's like the weirdest damn thing. It's the same instructors from the campus, but they come to prison, you know. Yeah. It's like, and I guess, you know, hopefully they get paid extra.
Wow.
Because we weren't always the easiest to deal with, but it's the same book, same exams, like everything's the same. The only, you know, the big difference, the advantage for us was that we didn't have the distractions that you have on the street. You know, we don't have girlfriends, we don't have jobs, we don't have family obligations. We're just like, here you are, you know, like, what else are you gonna do?
Yeah.
So it's like, so I took advantage of that. Mm. And I actually got a bank loan when I was in prison, which is the funniest damn thing. Your family can mail you like money orders, like whenever they want, so that you can buy things on commissary, like anything from Little Debbie's to coffee to toothpaste. And I had managed to save more money than I spent. And I read a book, and I don't remember if it was The Wealthy Barber or something, but I read some financial book in there, and I thought, man, I've really got to like start working on my credit. I don't have any credit at all. I don't have any bad credit, but I don't have any good credit. So I thought, you know, I want to prepare myself so that when I get home, that I put myself in the best possible position to have a decent life. And so I thought, well, let me get to open up a bank account. At least I can get that done. And then open a bank account, and I had like, I don't know, $500 or $600 in there. And then I got this like idea, man, what if I get a loan from the bank for $500, a secured loan, so that they have nothing to lose. And then I'll just mail them a money order every month to start paying off the loan. Mm-hmm. And my grandma helped me put it together. Like, she went to the bank and got the application and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And I managed to open up a bank account and then get a loan from a bank and start making the payments. So, and when I got out, I like paid the rest of it off, and I started to establish credit like that. It was just, it just shows that it doesn't matter where you're at. If you put your mind to it, you can really make a difference in your own life and the lives of others. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, right before maybe 6 months or so before I got out, this is like the happiest ending in the world. I had a girlfriend in high school that was in normal, like, you know, did good in school, didn't do drugs. We were in love, like high school love, but we were in love. And I broke up with her because I knew where I was going. I knew she was going to college and I was going to prison. Like, that's, you know, there was just no way around it for me. I knew it even in high school. I knew it. And so I broke up with her and she was devastated. I felt like the worst guy in the world for that. And I made up some, I made up a BS reason to break up with her, that she was messing with some other guy. I knew she wasn't, but I just, I needed to have something because I couldn't tell her the truth at that age. Like sometimes you, like, you know, stuff on the inside, but you're not able to verbalize it. And so at the time, like I just wasn't able to verbalize it. Like I knew what it was, but I couldn't really put it together. And so I actually wrote her when I first got locked up and told her how things turned out. You know, like here I am in jail. And she wrote me back and she said she thought she saw a sketch that looked just like me on a wanted poster in Baltimore County. I said, well, yeah, it was probably me. And then a few months before, maybe 6 months before I got out, I wrote her back just to tell her how things had turned out. Like, look, man, I'm, you know, I'm getting myself together. And, you know, I've, these are all the, you know, great things I did while I was locked up. And my only intention was like, I just wanted to like connect with somebody that was like normal. And I also wanted to like, you know, apologize to her. And so she wrote me back and she said, you know, that's great. Glad you're doing good. Don't write me anymore. And then I read that, you know, and I'm just like, okay, I understand that. We're never going to have any type of like friendship or anything. I had never even imagined like anything beyond like a pen pal. Like, it was just, you know, I was just too far gone. And she was like decent, you know, so like she wouldn't want to have anything to do with somebody like me. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to write her one more letter. And I'm going to tell her everything that I've always wanted to tell her, but didn't have the balls to. And I laid it all out. I was just like, this is why things worked out. And I've regretted it ever since. And I'm just sorry for any pain that I caused you. And she wrote me back a couple of weeks later and she says, well, you know, on second thought, we can write. A month or two later, she came up to see me and 2 years later, we got married.
Wow.
I have a ton of questions, but I know we haven't got to the real estate yet.
But yeah, I'm tearing up just talking about it, thinking about that whole thing. But well, you did ask.
I think that's an incredible story, and like you had us totally like just engaged. The one question I had for you that I prefaced before we even started the show was, so we have a brother that he passed away when we were like 30, and he was 32. Mm-hmm. But he never. A similar kind of
upbringing,
similar upbringing, similar path in high school and after he got out and in and out of jail, drugs, the whole nine dealing. But he never could change. Until his death, he never could turn around, change his narrative, I think is how we put it. Mm-hmm. You know, he was always known, he felt in his eyes, everybody looked at him in a certain way. And so like he almost like he had to live that character because it was, that's the way people, the world mm-hmm. saw him, and he couldn't change it and he couldn't be anybody else because that's the way the world saw him. And it didn't matter what people spoke into him or it just never could change. So I'm just curious, obviously it happened somewhere when you were locked up, I guess, in the books and the mind, but can you get how did you change that perspective? And you've said even with her emailing you back or writing you back and saying, like, don't ever write me again. Oh God, I think a lot of people would have been like, you know, cussed her out and, you know, just move, like, and then accepted that's I'm this criminal and nobody wants to accept me, but you still.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing that, like right there is like, when the attorney talked to you and said, hey, like, you know, you're stupid or whatever, right? And why are you doing mm-hmm. this? You know, and you thought about that and like, and the persistency of you, all right, like I need to change for myself, right? Where I think where you're getting at, Sean, is like, it's sometimes it's hard for, you know, when challenges are coming at you left and right to keep that mindset into, all right, I am going to do this for myself. I'm going to keep pushing through. Right. And for whatever reason, you just kept pushing through.
Yeah. I had a lot of time to do it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't suggest anybody deliberately go do what I did to get what I have, but it worked for me. And I'll tell you there were a couple of things that really made a difference. And I think that I'll tell you exactly what they are. The first thing was accepting 100% responsibility for where I was.
Mm-hmm. Taking
this isn't my mother's fault. It's not my father's fault. It's not, you know, it's not society's fault. This is me.
Right.
I did this. And so the first thing that I had to do was accept 100% responsibility mm-hmm. for it. The next thing, the big change for me was, like, I never had any confidence. Like, my whole self-esteem and all was built on mud. You know, it was just like, you know, get kicked out of school, can't hold down a job, drug addict, thief, liar, like all these, you know, terrible things. And I just wasn't able to, you know, think of anything really. Like, if somebody said, hey, man, name three good things about yourself, I wouldn't have been able to name any good things about myself. Mm. And so when you have that, you know, when you feel that way about yourself, and another thing is, I was constantly looking on the outside for the help. You know, I'm looking at the churches, I'm looking at the girlfriends, I'm looking at the rehabs, I'm looking at AA, thinking, well, if I move to a different place and have different friends, right. Like, I'm looking on the outside for all the answers. And so what I found was that the answers were all on the inside, but I had to change my own internal narrative from loser, bum, to somebody that has this, you know, immense potential. Like, I can go as far as I want, but I have to believe in myself before I do that. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'll use, like, sports, or particularly boxing, as an analogy, or even like a fight in a Home Depot. If you're, you know, some guy's walking across the parking lot towards you at Home Depot, and you know that you're getting ready to get into a fight, if your thoughts are, man, this guy's going to kick my butt, I hope he doesn't punch me in the face, you already lost.
Yeah.
Fight's already done. You already lost. Uh-huh. Before the first punch was thrown. But if this guy approaches you and you think to yourself, I'm going to tear his face off, like, his mother ain't going to know who he is when I'm done with him, you still might get your butt kicked. But the chances of being successful and winning are significantly greater if you believe in yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what the book did for me, is it took me from someone that didn't believe that I was capable of doing anything, that I was a complete loser, I'm destined to be a bum the rest of my life, and at the time thinking, you know, my life's going to be short and I'm probably going to die a violent death. I'll die a young violent death. Like, that was my narrative. To, I can do whatever I want and I can be whoever I want. And so what I started doing was I actually wrote down on a sheet of paper, it was a short list, but I started writing down all of the good things that I could think of that I had done in my life. And it wasn't much, but before the drugs, I mean, I used to, like, go around and knock on doors to collect money for charities. Like, there used to be this thing on TV called Jerry's Kids, where they had a 24-hour telethon and you would donate money. And I went out and banged on every door in my neighborhood every year for that. And I never took a nickel out. I would take it down to the high school and dump it in this bin. And I did a lot of stuff like that. And then I also quit smoking. And so I listed all the things that I could think of that I had done that were nice and that were good. And I started to focus on those and say, that's who I am. Mm-hmm. This drug stuff, this isn't me. This isn't, I mean, I'm embarrassed and ashamed of this stuff. Like, I knew I was wrong and that's not who I am. And so then the next thing was, when I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, like, okay, this is where I've been the last 10 years. This is the direction I was heading. And it was just the weirdest thing. I was sitting in my cell and I was thinking, well, who were you when you were 11? Like, who were you? And the answer was, you were a good kid, you know, and was doing the things that I mentioned, and I was kind to people and I was sensitive to other people's feelings. And, you know, I was a decent kid. And then I realized, like, that's who I am. Like, I'm still that person. All this other crap was somebody that was, like, under the influence of drugs and that whole lifestyle. Mm-hmm. That's not who I really am. And once I realized that I'm not a bad person. That's my dog.
Yeah,
I think he doesn't like the mailman. Dogs hate mailmen for some reason. So, I think that once I realized that I could take control of my life and I started listing the decent things about me and began to realize that that's the person that I really am, everything changed. Mm. And it was that book that was the pivotal moment where I was halfway through it. And I'm telling you, it was like a light switch. I mean, it was just like from darkness to light. It was like, I remember the instant. I mean, it was probably the most, other than birth, it was probably the most important moment of my life.
Yeah.
When I realized that I can do this, I got it. And once I had that confidence, I mean, that flows through to even today, like nothing has changed.
Yeah.
And I beat all the odds in many different ways. And it was because of believing in myself that I could do it.
That's love awesome. That beating yeah. the odds. And now it shows like how you bought and sold so many doors in such a short period of time. I mean, so kudos to you for all that. It's an amazing story. Yeah. So
thanks for sharing. Yes. And just in case somebody out there is listening and no, it just needs hope.
You could edit out the first 25 minutes.
No, that's the goal there,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, they need help or they know somebody, you know, or they're going, you know, somebody in their family or... I think there's a lot more people are going through stuff like that.
Or you feel like you've hit rock bottom, right?
And people just need hope.
Yeah.
So thanks for sharing that all. But how did you parlay that now into real estate and...
managing over 100 doors, you know?
Yeah. How did you take from... You started with bank loan, but then how did you get...
I'm gonna go through between 1994 and 2002. I'm gonna give you like the 3-minute synopsis of that.
Let's do it.
Get out of jail. Get a job working in a factory making $6 an hour that I actually got before I even got out of jail. Got a job working in a factory at like $600-$700 in the bank. Moved in with my girlfriend like a month later, who's now my wife. And this is like something that always shocks people. I ended up going back to, I went to the University of Maryland, Baltimore County campus and majored in biochemistry. And cause I'd always wanted to be a scientist. I was, you know, like I loved chemistry. I loved biology. I loved geology, like all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going there majoring in biochem, got a job working part-time in a lab. The easiest way back then to find jobs, like nobody else did this but me, I would say, what do I want to be today? Do I want to be a plumber? Do I want to work at Pepsi? And I would just get out the yellow pages. I even got a job working on a horse farm through the phone book. I turned to laboratories and I just started calling them. And I got down to the C's and I called this place called CTE and asked if they were hiring any lab techs. And they said, well, yeah, by the way, we are. And I talked to the guy on the phone and I went in and I got hired that day. Oh. And that's how I got my first lab job. And then that didn't last long. We ended up getting laid off like a year later. Then I went to work for another company as a temp. And they had a bunch of layoffs after I started there. And I saw that there really weren't any jobs in the sciences like I had been led to believe my entire life. But I kept seeing, this is like 1988, I guess, all of these computer jobs in the newspaper. I mean, the internet was just really coming into people's homes in the, you know, mid 90s. I'm seeing all these IT jobs and I'm reading the salaries and I'm like, man, like 1 year's experience, $100,000. I'm just like, man, these guys aren't that smart. Like I see the guy coming and hook up the printer. He's not that smart. He's making that kind of money. I'm going to change majors. So I started doing the IT stuff. And a friend told me, don't waste your time with a college degree, get these computer certifications. And I listened to him and I started, he was in the IT business and I started getting these computer certifications, got a job working at Legg Mason on a help desk as a temp. Ended up losing that job 6 months later because they found out I was a felon. They were actually going to offer me full-time employment. And I told my boss I was, you know, what had happened, and security promptly came to her office and escorted me down to the gutter. But I was like, I was cool with it. I'm like, all right, you know, this is part of it. This is part of my baggage. And this is, it's 100% my fault. Like I should have listened to my mother. And I found another job that paid better, where I learned more, and I stayed there for a while, and then ended up where a couple of years later, I was teaching computer classes in colleges all over the state of Maryland. and I was teaching these computer certification classes, and they were paying me $100 an hour to do it. And it was crazy. You know, I was making, you know, back then 130 to 150 a year, which in the year 2000, 2001, that was a lot more than it is now. And I had a GED and 2 years of college that I got in prison. And I was making that much money. Mm-hmm. And I saved it, you know, it's just like, cause I know what it's like to be homeless and broke. Mm-hmm. And so like, I really valued like, man, I got $30,000 in the bank. I'm like, I'm not going to get by a big house. I'm not going to get by an expensive car. I'm just going to keep saving my money. And, you know, I started investing in the stock market and made a ton, lost everything I made when they had the dot-com, mm-hmm. you know, bubble. But I didn't lose like my principal. So I had about so I took everything out. I think I had like 120, 130,000 that I'd saved over maybe 2.5, 3 years. And I thought, well, what am I going to do with this money? Like, you know, the stock market's BS. I saw the inner workings when I worked at like Mason. Like I know a little bit how the stuff works. And I decided to do this rental thing. And I didn't know anybody. I mean, this is 2001 when I made that decision. And there were no like, there was no Bigger Pockets. There were no podcasts. There was no Google, you know. Rich Dad, Poor Dad was still poor. You know, like everything was different.
Russ Whitney was back then. That's who
I never heard of him. Yeah. But there were no, like, I didn't know of any RIAs. I mean, meetup.com didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And I put together an Excel spreadsheet to calculate my cash on cash return. And I thought, I want a 30% cash on cash return. And part of the reason I want to buy rental properties is because my wife wasn't working for a few years. She decided when her son was born that she didn't want to work for a couple of years, which was cool. I was making enough money to support everybody. And then she decided she wanted to get back to school. She had a bachelor's degree, but she wanted to become an RN. So she had to get back to school for a couple of years. So I was cool with it. Like, you stay in school as long as you want. I don't care. Like, I mean, there's, you know, you can never go wrong with getting a decent education. And if mm-hmm. it's something that you want to do, then, you know, I support you 100%. So I continued doing what I was doing, saving the money. And then I thought, like, man, what if I get hit by a car or get sick or something? Like, then there's no money coming in and then we're screwed. And so I thought, well, if I start buying these rentals and I make a few hundred dollars a month off each one, $200-$300 a month, if I get like 15 or 20 of them, then there's enough money coming in where we can just pay our, you know, cover our basic stuff, you know, food, mortgage. Mm-hmm. I didn't even have a cell phone back then. I think I had a pager. And that was it. And that's what started it. And then what happens is, you know, it gets addictive. And I mm-hmm. already have an addictive personality. If I like something, I just keep doing it. It's the weirdest thing. So, and I liked getting, you know, renting a house out, you know, and making 30% on my money, making, you know, $300 a month off of a $13,000 investment. And I just kept doing it. Yeah. And the first one was the hardest. The first one, it's just like, you know, it's kind of weird saying this in this political environment, but I'll use myself as an example. The first time I kissed a girl, now you can kiss anybody. I kissed a girl and I was scared. Like, man, you know, I was probably like 11, and then I'm just like, do it right. Does she think I'm stupid? You know? And then the second time you kiss her, it's a little bit easier. The third time, you know, by the time you've kissed her 10 times, it's like nothing. Buying houses is the same way. The first time is the hardest. It's scary. Am I doing it right? Am I stupid? Do my tenants think I'm almost said it. Do my tenants think I'm a jerk? But then by the time you like, you get your second one, it's a little bit easier. By the time you're on your 20th, when you're buying the house, you haven't even been inside of it. Yeah. Just because you become so comfortable with the numbers and the environment, you know,
yeah,
things work. And so I just kept going. I mean, and then I didn't, like back then, I didn't know people could own 100 houses. Like I had no idea. It's like, you know, I'm just thinking. And people, as soon as you have two or three properties, they think you're rich. You know, your family members, man, you got three houses, you know, it's like, and they, all of a sudden they just put you in this whole different thing. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing was just so weird. And then a couple of years in, I started meeting other people that were doing it that, you know, that had five rentals, 10, 20, 30. And then that really shortens your learning curve when you can meet other people that have done it ahead of you and learn from them. I missed out on that the first couple of years. I was kind of by myself. And so it was just, I don't want to tell you all the details because it would take too long. But a few years later, I met somebody that we started wholesaling together. Mm-hmm. And that was around 2005, maybe 2006. I quit the IT stuff. My wife got a job as a nurse. And so I was making $50,000 a year off the rentals. She was making $50,000 a year right out of school. So if I quit my computer job, there's a $50,000 gap between what I was making. Cause I didn't, the rental money like didn't go towards our day-to-day income. That all went back to the business. Mm-hmm. And I figured out this burr thing, which I'll tell you about in a couple minutes. But anyway, yeah, let me just get to the burr thing. Cause that was kind of in the middle of this. Mm-hmm. So the burr thing, I never heard of burr, like the buy, renovate, you know, rent out, refi, repeat. But I thought of it one day cause I was doing these rehabs and I was always afraid to do like retail flips because I always had this thought like, man, what if nobody buys my house? Then what am I going to do? I got to pay this hard money lender, you know, 15%. And if I don't pay him back in 6 months, then he's going to start charging even more points. And this is like, could be a disaster. And then I thought, well, I guess if I can't sell it, I could just rent it out and refinance it and pay him back and then just keep it. And then I thought, what if I just bought it with the original intention of renting it out and then refinancing? Mm-hmm. And once I thought of that, it was like everything changed. The first one I did was a 15-unit building. It was seven commercial spaces and 8 apartments. And the 8 apartments were vacant, needed significant renovation. And that was the first burr that I did. And I actually still have that building. I'm going to sell it this year, I hope. Mm-hmm. But that was the first big thing that I did with the burr method. And after that, like I hardly used any of my money for any of the other buildings that I bought. And I bought a lot of, you know, houses. The biggest building I had was 18 apartments and 9 garages. I had a 14 unit, 13 unit. I flipped a 10 unit that I was going to keep and ended up selling it.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of houses. And it was all, you know, with very little or nothing out of my pocket. Mm. And one of the tricks to that, like people won't get this, but when you're dealing with hard money, like one of the things that I did was, this was with the first lender, second lender that I started using. He was an attorney. And on the first of the month, I didn't like mail him a check. I went to his office and I'd go in and they'd say, can I help you? I'd say, well, I don't want to say his name, but I'd say, hey, I'm here to see Mr. Blank. And they would say, is he expecting you? And I'm like, well, not expecting me, but he'll be happy to see me. and you know, I just hand him the check and I'd say, Mr. Blank, here's your interest payment. I really, you know, appreciate, you know, you're putting your trust in me and everything on the job's going fantastic. And again, I really appreciate it. And I'll see you next month.
Yeah.
I wanted him to know me. I wanted him, if he saw me in a grocery store, to say, hey, that's Mark Owens. He's one of our, you know, borrowers. Like I wanted him to know me.
Yeah.
And it worked. I mean, I knew it worked when I was standing out in front of a 13 unit building and I called him up and we were on a first name basis by this time. And I said, Jim, I'm standing out in front of this 13 unit building on York Road. The prices are embarrassing now to say. It's $325,000. Half the units are vacant and need a little bit of renovation. Mm-hmm. I'd like to borrow like $400,000. What information do you need from me? And he said, Mark, I'll call you back in a minute. So I thought I interrupted him, you know, he was in something. And then he called me back and he says, all right, you got it. He didn't know the address of the property. He didn't know anything. He was just based on our relationship, me showing up, handing him the check, thanking him, keeping informed. When the guy came out to the inspections for the draws, like I'd always done more than what I said I had done. Mm-hmm. So there was never any, like a lot of people get behind the eight ball and, you know, tell their lender, yeah, the kitchen's done. And, you know, the guy comes out to do the draws and the kitchens are in boxes on the floor in the kitchen. Yeah. Kitchen's not done. You know, it's you're messing up your reputation, man. Just wait a couple of days till the cabinets are hung and then call them. And yeah, a lot of people just, this need for immediate gratification or to get caught behind the eight ball. They don't have any reserves to use. There's a whole lot of different reasons why people do that. But in the long run, they're never good enough.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so crucial because it's, especially in today's world with texting and emailing, like that old school, just number one, do what you say you're going to do and follow through. But just that personal connection, I think, in relationships that people.
Absolutely. I think it's awesome. Everything you've done, life experience and, you know, getting to where you're at right now. Mark, what is your next?
Yeah, what is my next? I know. I could talk for like 2 hours. We've sold, I think right now I've got 22 units left, and one of those is supposed to settle today. I've got another, most of them are going to be gone by the end of this year, maybe all of them. I'm the tables have turned and I'm the lender. So I'm lending money out, and which is a lot easier.
Yeah.
Really. And there's no regulation in it. It's the craziest damn thing. You can make 12%, 15% on your money, and there's zero regulation. As long as you pay your taxes. And I don't mind doing that. I like having roads and schools and fire departments and stuff like that. So I don't mind paying taxes. The next thing, I don't know, man, it's up to my wife.
Yeah. You know,
she's a travel nurse. So I think we bought an RV a few years ago. So my plans were like, I just want to travel around like, you know, North America and that, mm-hmm. like, and so we've been,
very cool.
We've probably spent 15 months in it since 2020.
Yeah.
Now we're in an Airbnb because I'm not bringing our RV to South Dakota in the winter.
And, that
wouldn't have been good. So,
well, that's awesome.
We've got plans. My son, he graduated from he went to Alabama, and now he's an investment banker analyst.
Oh, cool.
I don't know how that happened. I didn't know that they drew investment bankers out of Alabama, but that's nice. What he did. Got a great job. He's an amazing son. Could not have done better. I mean, I was talking to my wife about it the other day, just how just amazing he is, like just, you know, the kind of person he is. And grateful for that. I don't know what's next.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I have a lot of choices, and I still like, I coach some people. Most of it is like, I mean, it's very, and I'm not even doing that anymore other than the clients that I already have.
Yeah.
Where it's just, it's very rewarding to help people. So I spend a lot of time on Facebook, like answering questions and different groups and stuff like that, because there's nothing more exciting for me to see other people succeed. Like I've done it. Like I don't have to be any more successful than I already am. I couldn't be any happier than I am today.
Yeah.
But what does get me is when I see somebody else do it. Like that's like, I love seeing people win. I love it. And that's why I'm here. I mean, if I can, you know, and I'm sure that's why you created this podcast.
Exactly. Yep.
You want to inspire other people and help other people. And sometimes you probably get emails from somebody that says, hey, I listened to this podcast you guys did. It's so great. And I really got so much out of it. And that's the payback right there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Got a text this week from somebody that just said they had some big takeaways and they mentioned it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the part of the story that we skipped over was, that you really created a vision of the how you guys wanted to live, and you know, and you wanted to be more mobile and travel and sold off a portion of your portfolio to do that and have that freedom. But if you could go back into your early 20s, what would you tell that version of you back? I guess, well, obviously you were maybe at a different state, but I mean, what if you, you know, for somebody, maybe it's just advice, like what, if somebody young that's just starting out, you know, what, with all your experience and life lessons, what is there a big takeaway or a couple that you would recommend to that person? Or
I'll try to keep it short. one of the things is to try to find someone else that is already doing what you want to do. I don't care if they're real estate investors, you want to be like a plumber, whatever it is, find somebody else that's already doing it. The winners want to see you win. The real winners want to see you do well. And it's going to make them feel good. It's going to be a feather in their cap if they can help to lead you to an amazing life. So find someone else that's already doing it. It can shorten your learning curve by a decade, even more. So I would start with that. So that's what I would tell myself, is find somebody else that's already doing what I want to do. And back then it was just like, get my life together, like just, you know, kind of like be normal. That was like my dream, was just to be normal. And don't lose faith in yourself. Like, focus on the good about yourself, not the bad.
Love that.
Because we can always, nobody's better at beating us up than we are.
Yeah.
You know, and we all have that negative self-talk. I'm ugly. And, you know, stop it. You know, it's like, you remember, you probably don't, but there was a guy, I think it was Saturday Night Live, and he would look in the mirror and say, oh, you're wonderful and people like you. And like, as corny as it sounds, like that self-talk really does make a difference.
It does. Words of affirmation.
one of the things that I did, which is like the weirdest thing, and it's like, when I get those like bad faults, I never get them now, but mm-hmm. when I did, like that, those feelings, it's a feeling before you can even put it into words. Mm-hmm. Like before you think, man, I want to go buy some heroin, you get a feeling, mm-hmm. and then it's followed by that thought. Well, as soon as I would get these feelings, I would literally yell out loud in my cell. And I would yell at that feeling as though it were disconnected from me sitting on a chair. Like, imagine if your dog was getting ready to go to the bathroom on your bed. Like, you wouldn't just sit there and watch. You'd jump up and, oh, like, you want to stop it immediately. Yeah,
absolutely.
And I did the same thing. Like, and, you know, when I quit smoking, it's like, man, I really want a cigarette. And mm-hmm. I would literally, I'm not going to use the language on here that I used then, but I would, like, screw you. I'm not doing it. You can get behind me. And I got that, you know, from... you know, there was this guy named Jesus that lived a couple thousand years ago, and he told the devil to get behind him. The devil tempted him for 40 days, and he yelled at him and said, "Get behind me, Satan." Mm-hmm. And I had read that, and I thought, well, if it worked for him, you know, I'm gonna have to try that. Yeah. And I started yelling out loud. And I'm sure my cellmates, you know, they're probably like,
that's like, awesome.
Stay away from that guy, man. He's like, he ain't wrapped you.
Yeah.
But it, I mean, it really, like, mm-hmm. and the thoughts, like, left like that. I mean, it was the most incredible thing.
Yeah.
I should try that with, like, dessert now.
But Jesus is way more important than the person I'm going to mention now. But the I just listened to a podcast, and I think it was Tom Bilyeu had mentioned that, too, that he's, like, big on that. He screams out, like, and it's usually like F you, whatever. Or like him and his wife have something that they say, like if they're fighting, they yell out mm-hmm. to each other, and then they have to yell out. So anyways, you're going to create a bunch of people yelling and screaming and going down the road screaming at each other.
What's that guy's name? Those
are awesome takeaways, Mark.
Yeah.
So how can people get a hold of you?
Email is the best way. mark@markowens.com. That's
awesome.
It.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm not selling anything, you know, so
yeah.
If you need some help or advice or something like that, I answer all of them.
Perfect. So. Well, you've added a ton of value. Yeah, I mean, it's today's episode was great. I think there's a lot that our listeners can take from, so we really appreciate you being on the show today.
But wait, there's more. So, yeah, listen, I really appreciate the opportunity. I mean, I know this is like, I don't think people realize how much work this is for you. Like to put these together and find guests that are going to, you know, hopefully add some value. And I mean, it's a lot of work. And, and people don't get it. For every hour that they're watching you, there's probably like 5 or 6 hours or more behind the scenes to make this hour possible. So, I really appreciate both of you putting the time and effort into this to help, you know, potentially thousands of people.
Yeah,
I really appreciate
it. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. All right, guys. Well, if you like this show, please, you know, refer it to a friend, like it. And
you know anybody that's going through maybe a similar story and just needs some hope and inspiration, I think share it with them. I think that goes a long way. So, but thank you, guys. And thank you, Mark. And everybody, we'll see you all next week.
See ya.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkle. Tons of entrepreneurial podcasts are out there talking.
Talking.
But Joni and Sean are living it every single day. Their portfolio now includes many franchises and medium-sized businesses. We talk about the trials and motivators of successfully running a business. Join us again soon for another podcast. But until then, reach out on the website at InsideTheWolf'sDen.com, on Facebook at Inside the Wolf's Den, on Instagram at Inside the Wolf Den. We'll see you again soon. This is Inside the Wolf's Den. We'll see you next time.